go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! You know, it's when you consider, hi, I'm Bob, for those new to the program, it's when you consider things momentous within the context of things prosaic that clarity really shines through. Wow, is that a broad generalization? Yes, yes it is. But work with me here. We'll figure it out. Welcome to the program. Welcome to this Thursday edition. We are officially 3 weeks into May, and I'm wondering where May went. I got to tell you, this is, you know, we've had 2 days of hooky forced and unforced and technical versus medical this week. But I just about had to be dragged in from outside. Mercy, it's beautiful out there today. Clear, high sky, not a cloud in sight. Blue, blue, blue as far as the eye can see above the greening of the mountains, what's left of them. And days like this always remind me of a lesser-known poem by Robert Frost. When he says something on the order of, "Oh, stormy, stormy world, the days you were not furled in mist and cloud, are days so very few I cannot help but wonder whence I get the lasting sense of so much warmth and light." It may be altogether that from one day's perfect weather, when starting clear at dawn, the day swept clearly on to finish clear at eve, and you and I walked from house to wood for change of solitude. That's pretty close. It may not be word for word, but that's pretty close. And it became ingrained in my memory specifically because of beautiful days like this, when the sky goes on forever. And the name of that poem is, well, there's a beautiful truth in it, an ironic and cutting truth as well. The name of that poem is "Happiness Makes Up in Height for What It Lacks in Length." And it's so very true. And thus it was kind of hard to come in the, you know, because here in the hills, even on the 21st day of May, you can still remember the bitter cold of winter. And you're still a little bit surprised to see things turning green and beautiful again, and seeing the rebirth of life come back into the mountains. And it was gorgeous. Oh, it was gorgeous. I don't care what I would... I had, in short, I had to be dragged back in. But I'm glad to be here. And I hope you are as well. I know that so many of you find these 3 hours somehow satisfying, whether you get a laugh or a cry or a scream or that you are as gratified with the 3 hours as I am in having your company. And so it was this afternoon, with the sky miles high and aching blue. that our peace, our tranquility, was shattered by the quick, distant roar of United States attack aircraft. Oh, I guess they're just on a training run in some sort of mission from some maybe state air national guard or maybe some national air, maybe Norfolk Naval Air Station, God knows what. But they came roaring, flying low, skimming the tops of the mountains themselves. They came roaring into our sight and out of our sight. A pair of, I don't think they were F-15s. Maybe they were, it had the single tail section. It was the smaller of the fighters, it looked like. I can't tell them on sight. Made a tremendous racket. Frankly, it's unsettling. Into view and out of view in a matter of a couple of seconds, with a prodigious roar behind them, and little warning but the shattering of the air ahead of them that they were coming. And you're hard-pressed to tell which direction from whence they come. And seeing them, I thought of something that I read within the last day or so, something that I thought would be worth sharing with you. Yeah, maybe an F-16, Lottie. I think you're probably right, F-16. But I wanted to share something with you I found this over at BuzzFlash. Commentary by Dave Lindorf. It was posted yesterday at BuzzFlash. Headline, Dave Lindorf, caught in a lie, U.S. is using white phosphorus in Afghanistan as a weapon. He writes, when doctors started reporting that some of the victims of the U.S. bombing of several villages in Farah province last week, what do we care? They're Afghans. Barely human anyway, right? When doctors started reporting that some of the victims of the U.S. bombing of several villages in Farah province last week, an attack that left between 117 and 147 civilians, otherwise known as innocents, dead, most of them women and children. When doctors started reporting that some of the victims were turning up with deep, sharp burns on their body that looked like they'd been caused by white phosphorus, the U.S. military was quick to deny responsibility. You know white phosphorus. It gets on your skin and it won't burn out until it's burned through. Yeah, there's no putting it out. It is a horror weapon. Well, one moment, please. So, stand by, please. More fun with the phone. Okie doke. Sorry for the interruption. That was just a half to call. So let's get back to kind of where we were. David Lindorf, I believe, published over at BuzzFlash. White phosphorus. Let's see, where were they? Where were we? Official military policy on the use of white phosphorus is to only use the high-intensity, self-igniting material. Self-igniting, isn't that charming? As a smoke screen during battles or to illuminate targets, not as a weapon against human beings, even enemy troops. Of course, we proved our willingness to use white phosphorus on brown people. Where? Fallujah? Was it Fallujah? I believe it was. Now that policy and the military's blanket denial that phosphorus was used in Farah have to be questioned thanks to a recent report filed from a remote area of Afghanistan by a reporter from the New York Times. C.J. Chivers, these names, who knows, Chivers, no. Writing in the May 14th New York Times, in an article headlined Korangal Valley Memo in Bleak Afghan Outpost Troops Slog On, wrote of how an embattled U.S. Army unit in the Korangal Valley of Afghanistan had come under attack following a morning memorial service for one of their members, PFC Richard Demeter, who had been killed the day before by a mine. Chivers wrote, after the ceremony, the violence resumed. The soldiers detected a Taliban spotter on a ridge, which was pounded by mortars and then white phosphorus rounds from a 155-millimeter howitzer. What did the insurgents do? When the smoldering subsided, they attacked from exactly the same spot, shelling the outpost with 30-millimeter grenades and putting the soldiers on notice that the last display of firepower had little effect. The Americans escalated. An A-10 aircraft made several gun runs, then dropped a 500-pound bomb. Lindorf writes, it is clear from this passage that the military's use of the phosphorus shells had not been for the officially sanctioned purpose of providing cover. The soldiers had no intention of climbing that hill to attack the spotter on the ridge themselves. They were trying to destroy him with shells and bombs. In fact, the last thing they would have wanted to do was provide the spotter with a smoke cover, which would have helped him escape and which also would have hidden him from the planes that had been called in to make gun runs at his position. Nor was this a case of illuminating the target. The incident, as Chivers reports, took place in daylight. Clearly, then, the article shows that it is routine for soldiers to call in phosphorus rounds to attack enemy soldiers, which is supposed to be against U.S. military policy for this material, and whoever was manning the howitzer had a stock of the weapons on hand and was ready to fire them. We, of course, the United States issued a blanket denial of having used them. Including, Fallujah, November 2004. The Pentagon then sort of had to weasel around and say, no, we used the white phosphorus as a screen to hide our troops. But finally, in 2005, the Pentagon kind of came out and said, well, yeah, we used white phosphorus directly as a weapon against enemy Iraqi troops in the assault on Fallujah. Okay? We did. Yeah. And now, civilians. Non-combatants. Are having it used on them in Afghanistan. Between 117 and 147 civilians dead, most of them women and children. Terrorist women and children! Because, of course, they all are, aren't they? Yeah. And so it was, and I realize there's been a little bit of, this is a little bit attenuated because of the break in the program there. But we're going to close this loop. So it was that in the high blue sky, as those American fighter jets roared across my vision in a matter of seconds, so it was that in the subsiding shriek of their engines, I looked up and had one of those dangerous, empathetic moments. My son was standing beside me. He said, "Wow, that's cool." And I was forced to admit they are beautiful of their sort. Exquisite pieces of engineering detail. Fascinating uses of the powers of science. But I looked at Ferg and I said, "Son, did you see how long those were in your vision?" "Yeah," he said. I said, "Consider. Consider that that is precisely how long it takes for an entire village in Iraq or Afghanistan, two countries that never lifted a finger against us. That is precisely how long it takes for us to reduce one of their villages filled with children who a few moments before may have been playing, or babes a few moments before suckling at the breast. That, son, is how long it takes for us to deliver hell, agony, anguish, damnation, and murder from the sky." And I am not able to look at the, knowing the uses to which we are putting a military that should have been used only for self-defense, knowing the uses we are putting those little miracles of engineering and modern science, knowing the uses we're putting them to, and knowing how the people on the ground feel, I too understood that fear. A second and a half? 2, maybe 3 seconds in your vision? And nothing but a muted roar and a shrieking, air-shredding howl in its wake? And the people you love most in the world are dead. Or perhaps worse, laying in pieces, writhing in agony on the ground, and begging for death. They haven't any guns. They haven't any mortars. They have only the desire to live to see tomorrow. And we use those weapons to make sure that they don't. Is it just me, or does that strike? Does it make sense what I'm talking about? And if you live near an Air Force or a Naval Air Station, you become accustomed to it. I remember back in the days when I would get up every afternoon and ride my dinosaur down to CNN Center when I lived in Atlanta to go to work. I lived near Dobbins Air Force Base in Myrtle. And invariably, because I worked a late shift, I would be trying to go to sleep when the fine folks at Dobbins would send fighter aircraft howling and shrieking over the top of my apartment. It was, to say the least, frustrating. Often terrifying. And I guess you can become immune to it, but it doesn't happen a lot around here. But the sight of those two fighter aircraft, that I suppose still instills a number, instills swellings of pride in some people. Gave me a moment to contemplate the horror that is perpetrated in our name. And horror it most assuredly is. Because in those couple of seconds, flashing before my mind's eye was that baby at the breast. Was that group of children frolicking on the dusty earth. Was the farmer in his field. Was the wedding party and the bride and groom, no matter what one says about their religion or their culture, the bride and groom who were somehow fulfilling a destiny that's been manifested generation after generation, yea, verily, unto the very origins of time itself in that region. And that tableau in my mind's eye of a bride slaughtered on her wedding day, of a groom murdered on his, done by you and me, because we can no longer evade our responsibility for this. To paraphrase Richard Nixon, we don't have George Bush to kick around anymore. The civilian slaughters are happening on our watch now. And, you know, we talked a little bit last night about this idea of compromise and being reasonable. I won't compromise on this one either. You ask me and I will tell you. I will tell anyone. And I will not back down. That what we are doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, no matter the rationalizations, no matter the subterfuge-laden excuses, what we are doing there is wrong because it was born in evil. It was born in deceit. It was born in a murderous, psychopathic impulse. And nothing good can ever grow from that. When the seed in the ground is poisoned, what grows from it is poison too. And the fruit that falls from its limbs, they are poison as well. There is no good war in Afghanistan. There is no good war in Iraq. There is only the ongoing slander of what good America had to stand for in the past. And it's all part of this an utterly insane tableau. I don't know who was in the cockpit of those two fighter aircraft. But I know one person who wasn't, and that's Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach, a decorated U.S. Air Force fighter pilot. He estimates $25 million was spent teaching him, training him to get in that marvel of engineering and science. Teaching him mentally and physically to go and drop massive horror-inducing weapons on villagers and people deemed dangerous. Whoever was in those two planes, and whoever was responsible for the slaughter of between 117 and 147 innocents in Afghanistan last week, it was not Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach. Because, see, Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach is getting drummed out of the military. Because Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach couldn't stand the claustrophobic enclosure of the closet anymore. Oh, this is a real horror for America. A Top Gun. A decorated fighter pilot. And he's gay. How can it be? Somebody call Fred Phelps. He appeared, I guess, a couple of nights ago on Rachel Maddow's program. The audio is worth hearing.
That we begin tonight with a man named Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach, an F-15 fighter pilot, an 18-year veteran of the United States Air Force. On September 11th, Colonel Fehrenbach...
18 years? Oh, dear Jesus, Rachel, he's been all gay for 18 years in our whole heterosexual, heroic American Air Force plane flying, oh, 18 years, and he's been a-doing all that. Oh, the flag is falling. Oh.
Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach was picked to be part of the initial alert crew immediately following the 9/11 attacks. The following year, in 2002, he deployed to Kuwait, where he flew combat missions over Afghanistan, attacking Taliban.
And he took his gay with him. Oh!
Taliban and Al-Qaeda targets. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach deployed there, flying combat missions in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Over the span of his career, he has flown 88 combat missions, including missions that were the longest combat sorties in the history of his squadron.
And he done it gay. A shame. A shame.
He logged more than 2,000 flying hours, nearly 1,500 fighter hours, 400 combat hours. Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach is also highly decorated. He's received 9 air medals, including one for heroism. After 18 years...
He gayed up the air medals, too. Oh, I bet he saw the big board.
...years of active duty in the Air Force. This experienced, decorated fighter pilot says he is ready and willing to deploy again. He's ready to do whatever his country and the United States Air Force ask of him. The military is now firing him. He's just been informed by the U.S. military that his career is over. After 18 years of service, less than 2 years shy of being able to retire with a full Air Force pension, he's being discharged from the U.S. Air Force under the military's don't ask, don't tell policy.
If only he could have lived in the closet 2 more years. But if I understand correctly from my friends, when you finally decide that there is not room enough for you inside the closet, 2 more days is intolerable. From, I had an email the other day from our buddy David in Tennessee, where he described ads that he keeps hearing for military recruiters seeking native speakers of Urdu, Pashtun, Farsi, Arabic. Come be all that you can be in the Army, as long as all that you can be ain't got no gay in it. Because we'll fire your ass for being gay. We'll let you in the Army if you've got a rape conviction. We'll let you in the Army if you are maybe a gangbanger. We'll let you in the Army if you're crazier than 4 o'clock. But if you've ever had, no, you're not welcome to apply. And God forbid you come out of the closet. It don't matter how much we've spent training you. It doesn't matter if you are Eddie Rickenbacker, your own damn self. We are going to throw your Top Gun ass out. If your Top Gun has ever been a top or a bottom, then never mind the business about the gun. Kind of reminds me of Arlo Guthrie a little bit. Remember the part of Alice's Restaurant where he says, I was sitting there on the Group W bench, and they said, what are you in for? And I said, littering. And they all moved away from me on the Group W bench, and I said, and disturbing the peace, and they all moved back over toward me, and we was having a high old wonderful time. And then the shrink says, kid, do you think you're moral enough to join the military? And I said, you got a lot of damn nerve asking me if I'm moral enough to go and kill people because I've been convicted of littering. And this is that. That little bit of humor from the Vietnam anti-war movement, writ large and made manifest in 2009 in an act of sublime stupidity. Yeah, just a little more follow-up from Rachel Maddow.
Despite a record of documented heroism, an unblemished career, despite the fact that he estimates the U.S. military spent roughly $25 million training him, Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach is being fired. He was informed of his impending discharge in September. He and his lawyer have tried to delay his appeal as long as possible, hoping that the new president would fulfill the pledge that he made as a candidate to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So far, that hasn't happened. But today, there were two important developments on that front. The first is the Obama administration's decision to accept an appeals court ruling in favor of another discharged Air Force pilot. Essentially, that ruling said that the government has to prove why the continued service of a gay service member, in this case a woman, is a threat to military discipline.
You mean there's more than one? Our heroic flyers who dropped hell and damnation and agony and death all over little civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's more than one of them that's got the gay? Oh, Jesus. The terrorists are winning. Yeah. Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach says he had tremendous hope that President Obama would keep his promise and change Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and initiate what Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach calls a policy of non-discrimination. You know what? I bet you that pilot that killed them 147 or 117 Afghan civilians, I bet he was gay too. And I bet his targeting was off because he was busy studying the gay agenda. See what it does to America's heroic military. I don't know any other way to respond to this with sarcasm. Damn, that's dumb. And then, of course, you heard, and this all sort of, it really does, it all sort of loops together. Because you heard Mark Levin talking about President Obama's speech today. Well, for some reason or another, like that, you know, cranky, drunk old uncle who won't leave after the Thanksgiving dinner is over, Dick Cheney will not go away. And that's partially because, you know, any crazy old drunk-ass uncle at Thanksgiving has somebody who's enabling his drunk ass. And the same thing applies to Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney has organizations like the ultra-right-wing fascist American Enterprise Institute that invite him to come and, you know, it's the Washington equivalent of, here's a half a gallon of old Panther. come and suck this, go suck that down and come up and rave for us a little bit and we'll pay you. So with President Obama speaking today at the archives, Dick Cheney, really, you know, and those comments are true. Dick Cheney is being seen more now than he was during the 8 years when he was secretly running the government. So while Barack Obama is making a speech that, that Mark Levine found satisfactory, and with which I have a few problems myself, but also a few good words as well, there were some hints at, for instance, law and order, which is a bonus. Well, that was Dick Cheney was over there letting the conservatives know exactly what he thought of all of us. Oh, I don't know, all of us panty waist peaceniks who somehow object to dropping bombs on wedding parties and slaughtering 117 Afghans, the majority of whom are women and children, babes suckling at the breast, and you know, all that silly crap. Hey, everybody, look over there. Who is it? It's Dick.
In the years after 9/11, our government also understood that the safety of the country required collecting information known only to the worst of the terrorists.
Wait! Stop! Right there, Dick! You know, it's so easy. It's so easy to make an adolescent giggle. I'm sure you're hearing this. All you got to do is take a guy named Dick and forcefully call him Dick. My son is purple in the face. I haven't made him laugh this hard since. Dick, that's so good. Oh, it's going to be a shame when he grows out of his puerile adolescent phase when just saying Dick can make him spasm with paroxysms of laughter. Hey, Dick! See, it's like magic. No, but we got to stop there. If I can stop saying Dick long enough to hear what he said. Okay, take a breath. Take a breath, son.
In the years after 9/11, our government also understood that the safety of the country required collecting information known only to the worst of the terrorists.
And the worst known only to the worst of the terrorists. So are you telling us, Dick, that you really did capture Osama bin Forgotten and you just neglected to mention, because he's the worst of the terrorists, right? I mean, that's what Dick just said. He's the worst of the terrorists. The worst of the terrorists is Osama, you know, bin Laden. 6'7" tall, white robes, portable dialysis machine, cave. That guy! And when we had to get information from him, that's what Dick just said. No, I don't think he means that. I think he's talking about waterboarding a guy who was Osama bin Laden's valet parking guy. That's what the worst of the terrorists means to Dick.
In a few cases, that information could be gained only through tough interrogations.
God, even Dick's choking on it. You know, Ferg is way too young to know much about the Nixon administration or the opposition to Richard Nixon. You know, he was called Dick Nixon. And in fact, there were slogans out there in the anti-war movement, son. You're just going to love that. I think this will probably cripple him. There was a slogan out there that said, Dick Nixon before he dicks you. And, you know, that's another one we can revive, Dick Cheney before he dicks you.
Oh, my God.
Thank God for the Internet. I think I'd have about the $3.5 million worth of fines by now if I was on government-controlled buggy whip radio. Tough, did you hear? Tough interrogations. Oh, I was supposed to say that with a straight face. Oh, I think I died again. Oh, I'm back. Tough interrogations. Jesus Christ.
In top secret meetings about enhanced interrogations, I made my own beliefs clear. I was and remain a strong proponent of our enhanced interrogation program.
Not top secret anymore.
True. Did you notice the use of the word? Have you, in the course of listening to this program, have you reached that point where now the word feel, the word hope, the word believe, just anytime you hear it, it's like fingernails across a chalkboard to you, because it was, there it was!
In top secret meetings about enhanced interrogations, I made my own beliefs clear.
Beliefs. He didn't make clear his knowledge. He did not make clear facts. He made clear beliefs. Ding, 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 ding. Whenever a right-winger, whenever a Republican starts talking about beliefs, I believe for every cluster bomb that falls, a toddler dies. I believe for every white phosphorus grenade we lob, a mother burns. Yeah. Yeah, I made my beliefs known. I made it known. I made my beliefs known that I would personally like to waterboard Nancy Pelosi with battery acid.
Was and remain a strong proponent of our enhanced interrogation program. The interrogations were used on hardened terrorists after other efforts had...
You know, when your name's Dick Cheney, you don't want to talk about anybody being hardened. I think the juvenile stuff's rubbing off on me from him. They were hardened terrorists. They were really hardened terrorists. And, they were sweaty, hardened terrorists. And,
failed. They were legal, essential, justified, successful, and the right thing to do. Yet for all...
It's always the right thing to do. Oh, it's so right. So right. Oh! So right! Yeah, my God, I'm so ashamed of...
This is the best show ever.
No, this is not the best show ever, Ferg.
Yes, it is. It's awesome. I love it. It's better than school. Whew. Oh my God.
I'm going to get to that. Wait a minute. Here we go. Yeah. What was that again? I got to get it all set up, make it work. This is too much fun.
Ardent terrorist after other efforts had failed. They were legal, essential, justified, successful, and the right thing to do. Yet for all these...
Yeah, the right thing to do. So right. Yeah. So right. Little candlelight. Little wine. Little waterboard. Little screaming in the night.
You got the cool water when the fever runs high. You got the look of love light in your eyes, and I was in crazy motion till you calmed me down. It took a little time. Something goes wrong, I'm the first to admit it.
Not really.
I'm the first to admit it.
Never.
And the last one to know. If something goes right, boy, it's likely to lose me. It's apt to confuse me. It's such an unusual sight. Oh, I can't get used to something so.
so right. It was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do.
Exacting efforts to do a hard and necessary job and to do it right. We hear from some quarters nothing but feigned outrage based on a false narrative.
Really? Dick? Tune in, buddy. Tune in every night. Because I can tell you, if we were ever at the point where we were doing video, you'd see my face turning purple when I get really good and pissed at the thing, at the way you drag the flag of the United States through the mud and the muck and the feces and the blood and the urine of your victims. Yeah, no. See, Dick, my outrage ain't feigned. I don't have time for feigned outrage. False narrative? False narrative. We'll give him a chance here, but we're going to find out what about the narrative is false. What part of the torture victims at the concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay, what part of that narrative that describes a human being stripped naked and smeared with feces, what part of that narrative is false, Dick? Let's see if he's got an answer.
In my long experience in Washington, few matters have inspired so much contrived indignation and phony moralizing as the interrogation methods applied to a few captured terrorists.
This from a man who runs screaming into the night away from a microwave oven. Okay? Phony? Phony? Do you realize what he's just said about you? Do you realize what the man who was the Vice President of the United States and apparently still thinks he is relevant just said about you? Let it sink in.
It's successful and the right thing to do. Yet for all these exacting efforts to do a hard and necessary job and to do it right, we hear from some quarters nothing but feigned outrage based on a false narrative.
Here it comes.
In my long experience in Washington, few matters have inspired so much contrived indignation and phony moralizing as the interrogation methods applied.
Contrived indignation and phony moralizing. We're working people. Or we have been working people. Or we hope again someday to be working people. We are not the multimillionaire former head of Halliburton class CEO predator capitalist like Dick Cheney, who shot a guy in the face. Yes, Ferg, he did. We have to get up and go to work every day and carry Dick Cheney's undead ass on our backs. We don't have time for contrived outrage and phony moralizing. We moralize from a very genuine place, Dick. A place that says for many of us that we would not do to others what we would not have them do to us. But you, Dick, you would gladly do to others what you know that they will not do to you, but will do instead to people from working families all over America. Where are you going to be, Dick Cheney? Where are you going to be one of these days when it's an American soldier being waterboarded? Where are you going to be, Dick Cheney? One of these days, when it's an American soldier released in photographs with feces smeared all over him and howling dogs baying inches from his face. Where are you gonna be, Dick? 'Cause that's the day when I wanna know where you can be found. Because on that day, Dick, I want to make sure to tell that American serviceman or woman's family where you are. Because you will be the reason that their son, their daughter, their mother, their father, their brother, cousin, uncle, aunt, grandson, granddaughter.
You'll be the reason that that's happening to them, Dick. And I want to make sure that the entire extended family of that American soldier can find your undead ass. Because I want you, you brave, brave man who boldly stands before right-wing fascists and behind a microphone and chortles on about phony outrage and contrived indignation. I want you, Dick Cheney, to look them squarely in the eye and said, I loved it as much when they did it to yours as when we did it to them, because I'm evil. I get off on this stuff. I make Jeffrey Dahmer look like a choir boy. I'm that sick.
To a few captured terrorists. I might add that people who consistently distort the truth in this way are in no position to lecture anyone about values.
Dick, may I just point out that you're in no position to lecture anyone about lecturing anyone about values. You're criminally insane, aren't you? You are. You're probably wearing, like, barbed wire underwear and enjoy it. I love what it does to my skin. You're a sick man.
Intelligence officers of the United States were not trying to rough up some terrorists simply to avenge the dead of 9/11. We know the difference in this country between justice and vengeance. Intelligence officers were not trying to get terrorists to confess to past killings. They were trying to prevent future killings. From the beginning of the program, there was only one focused and all-important purpose. We sought, and we in fact obtained, specific information on terrorist plans.
Sure you did. The only problem, Dick, is that any information you got before you started the torture. You ordered the torture because you enjoy it. See, this is the way that a smooth psychopath like Dick Cheney can operate. And again, I defer to horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner on the definition of psychopath or sociopath. But he can sit there in broad daylight and tell you the truth and lie to you at the same time. Okay? Intelligence officers of the United States were not trying to rough up some terrorists simply to avenge the dead of 9/11. Operative word, simply. They were trying to avenge the dead of 9/11 on people who had nothing to do with 9/11. Sure they were, but it wasn't simply that. They were also doing it because it was based on orders from on high, from Dick himself, because Dick gets off on it. I know this is difficult to comprehend. I know this is a challenge to comprehend. But Dick Cheney is a sick, evil man. And he enjoys... Oh, what was it from Conan the Librarian or whatever? Arnold out there prattling away about the lamentations of the women. He enjoys that! The shrieks of babies as they die are music to his ears. The grievous howls of women suddenly made widows on their wedding day is like unto a heavenly chorus to a psychopath like Dick Cheney.
You and I have trouble with this because we can't comprehend evil that exists on that level. We cannot comprehend the depravity of the human spirit that results in the likes. Of Dick Cheney.
We are dealing with psychopathology here of a profound level. And so the loop closes. The loop that began on a brilliant, high, blue sky afternoon in the West Virginia hills when my peace and tranquility and solitude was ripped asunder by the shriek of a jet that in some other day, some other week, may have flown over similar hills in Afghanistan carrying loads of murder. And we understand why. We understand why. Because Dick Cheney Dick Cheney enjoys it. Dick Cheney digs it. Yeah. So it's about 9 minutes past the hour. We are 1 hour into the program. Your phone calls are welcome. You know that. Phone number, of course, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or if you want to save us a little bit of money, dial us direct, 304-658-3333. It's just that easy. Email comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com. Light them up. What do you think? Coming up, the Green News Report. It's Green News Thursday from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. A little break first. This is listener-supported activist radio. This is The Horn.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. Perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Once I get you up there, where where the air is rarefied. We'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together weather-wise. It's such a lovely day. You just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182. 82.
It's Thursday, May 21, 2009.
Clean energy and national security. Cafe standards and coffee cups. Plus, sausage making in Congress.
Ooh, all that more straight ahead from your Green News Report World News Headquarters in Los Angeles. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyle.
And this is your Green News Report.
Look at Area Indiana by the light switch.
Okay, I don't even want to think about the sausages in Congress.
We'll get to that.
Okay, here with the Green News headlines, Desi Doyen.
Ah, well, just in time for Memorial Day, a group of retired military officers released a stinging report this week examining the impact of America's energy choices on our national security, saying, quote, "The American military gave you the Humvee, and now we're taking it back." The retired 3- and 4-star generals and admirals from all four branches of the military call climate change a threat multiplier for global instability. They say that our reliance on fossil fuels undermines our security, and they call on the Department of Defense to lead the shift to clean energy as a national security priority. According to the study, in Iraq, only 10% of fuel used for ground forces actually gets used in vehicles. 90% goes to the delivery and security in getting the fuel to them in the field. Oil prices also affect the defense budget. The study says that every time the price per barrel goes up a dollar, it costs the Defense Department another $130 million.
Oh, why do 3- and 4-star retired generals hate America? Now, this study also found that the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, is what, the number one user of oil in the world? Do I understand that correctly?
I think you do. I'd have to go and verify that for sure, but yes, I do understand that is the case.
It's huge. They use huge, and so if they made changes there alone, that could be of great national security importance.
Well, the Defense Department is already making some moves. The Pentagon announced this week that a creation of a senior post dedicated to the study of the energy challenge for the Defense Department, and the Army is leasing 4,000 small electric vehicles for bases. And this week, researchers at the University of Iowa announced that through a Defense Department grant, they have found a way to use styrofoam in coffee cups and other packaging and other plastic waste to boost the energy output of biodiesel, which could be especially useful for troops in the field. Apparently, styrofoam melts like a snowflake when it comes into contact with certain types of biodiesel.
Wait, you're kidding. They're going to use styrofoam in the biodiesel fuel?
Yeah, they have to perfect the process still, but they say that they found the initial way to make it work so that if troops in the field have plastic waste, they can actually dump it within their own fuel and use that instead of trying to get delivery of fuel.
Well, that's a pretty huge headline. I mean, given how difficult it has been to get rid of styrofoam all of these years. Am
yeah,
I correct?
That would be great if they could make it work
Desi,
and make it scalable.
You have buried the lead. I think styrofoam coffee cups as gas is pretty cool.
Well, like I said, they still have to perfect the process. This is the very beginning of it.
Yeah, well, you buried the lead.
President Obama announced new mileage and emissions standards for the nation's cars and trucks this week, incorporating the more stringent standards that had been sought by California but blocked by the Bush administration. And predictably, right-wing commentators are against it, saying the effect on the environment will be negligible and calling it a new tax on consumers because the White House agrees the new standards will raise the cost of vehicles. But we should point out that half of that increased price is a result of a bill signed by President Bush in 2007. But the White House says the higher cost will pay for itself within 3 years due to money saved on gasoline. The president said, as a result, we would save 1.8 billion barrels of oil. And to give you a sense of that magnitude, that's more oil than we imported last year from Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Libya, and Nigeria combined.
Did you see crazy Senator Inhofe on TV saying that Americans have the right to drive gas hogs and it's outrageous that we would take that right from them?
Well, and it's ridiculous because there's no one changing that right. They're just saying that all classes of cars that will be new starting in 2016 will have to have this higher mileage standard. That doesn't mean that if you want to drive an SUV from 1995 that you have
you
to change
do it.
It.
Okay, well, that, I guess he's saying you're taking away my right to buy a new gas hog.
Right.
Inhofe is an idiot.
Recession is apparently a great way to reduce emissions and fuel use. The U.S. Energy Information Administration announced yesterday that the slump in the economy and sky-high fuel prices led to the first reduction in U.S. carbon emissions since 1982, almost 3%. You know how the legislative process is often compared to sausage making?
I do.
Well, I ain't kidding. Your humble servants here at the Green News Report have been monitoring the contentious tug-of-war going on in the House Energy and Commerce Committee right now as they mark up the Waxman-Markey American Clean Energy and Security Act in hopes of getting this bill out the door by Memorial Day.
And the debate has been ugly. We talked about this in the last Green News Report, how before they even started the markup, the Democrats themselves had compromised and watered the thing down. Now the Republicans are entering the fray.
Yes, they are following through on their pledge to slow down the process with literally hundreds of amendments. And late yesterday, we heard that House Democrats have hired a professional speed reader just in case the Republicans decide to exercise their right to read all 932 pages of the bill out loud.
Wait, who has hired a professional speed reader?
House Democrats.
They really have hired in order to do this?
Yep.
Cool. Now I hope it happens. All right.
Also, pollution industry spending on climate lobbyists has nearly doubled to $50 million just since January. And we have a map online that you should check out that shows state-by-state carbon emissions. And it shows that the representatives most against this climate legislation are from the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel-reliant states.
Really? Who would have thunk it? Knock me over with a feather. All right. Speed read about all of that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Sausage Making Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention
$24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Two past the hour, the usual excellent job by Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen with the Green News Report. I look forward to Tuesdays and Thursdays. Sorry we didn't get to run Tuesdays because I was being screwed over by Internet Explorer, which continues to screw me over. But we're getting by with Firefox, and I'm slowly getting used to it, I guess. So we will let us pick up the dialogue. Let us advance the discussion. And the conversation. This is, after all, conversation radio. And we go to Preston calling from Denver. Hey, Preston, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. I just had a nice chat with your son.
Yeah, he's every bit as loquacious as his father.
Yeah, great.
He's a good kid.
and like him, I also kind of chuckle at certain forbidden words.
You can't help it, can you? I mean,
no. I saw a lady actually on Current TV kind of make a similar remark about females' private parts and how it's treated in the culture. It reminded me actually of Beavis and Butthead, which I used to dismiss as just stupid for a long time, and I didn't pay attention to it. But after it had been on for like 3 years, and I looked a little more closely, and there's some really interesting subversive cultural critique going on there. And
oh yeah,
and
I mean, after all, that's Mike Judge, and that's the guy who brought us Idiocracy.
That's right. Little Mike Judge trivia, actually, he was born in Ecuador.
Oh really?
Yeah, forget the circumstance, what his parents were doing, but yeah. So he's a cosmopolitan view. And what else? Did you ever see Mystery Science Theater
3000? Oh, I loved MST 3000. MST 3K.
Yeah, brilliant. And again, very subversive in a way of some dominant paradigms and stuff, or perspectives.
Oh, in its earliest days, it was brilliant. Yeah. I think they struggled after a little while, but hardcore and edgy stuff.
Yeah, and the movie version I didn't like so much. They had an actual movie in the theaters, and that was kind of disappointing, but yeah. So many incredible episodes, though. And also, not just their critiquing, and but the skits that they would do in between as well.
Yes,
I think were amazing. But they actually did one thing regarding British colonialism in Africa, and it packed a wallop for sure. But anyway. I have to say I'm a little confused, though, regarding your son. His name, you call him Ferg.
Yeah.
And that's his...
That's just a nickname. Where that comes from, and other people have asked, so well, let's see. Where that comes from is he was nicknamed in the womb because I'm a big fan of Mark Twain. And there is a... The Innocents Abroad, he refers to all people whose name he doesn't know yet as, "See here, Ferguson." So I just referred to him when he was still, when his mother was still carrying. I just referred to him one day in front of my mother, who was around at the time and was very excited at the prospect of a grandson. I referred to him just casually, well, something, 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 Ferguson. And it stuck. And she started calling him Ferguson. And it just it stuck like glue, and he has been Ferguson or Ferg to this day.
Great, and his legal name is Bob, right?
Yeah, he's named after me.
Okay, that's what I thought.
He is, as we say around here, part two. The adventure continues. I love sequels.
Sounds good. Twain was also a member of a group called the Anti-Imperialist League.
You know, I was talking with my son a little bit about Sam Clemens a couple of days ago. He was not being kind about it when he coined the phrase the Gilded Age for the Victorians. He did not mean that as a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's ever spent any time reading The Man Who Corrupted Handley Berg or The Mysterious Stranger, Letters from the Earth, The War Prayer, any of those things, understands that in his maturation process and based upon the wounds and scars that he had received in this life, he became very much a realist and very much an agnostic and very much pessimistic person touching upon human nature and human conduct, and especially the conduct of government and those people that he saw and recognized as the imperialists.
Yep. I just did a quick search on Wikipedia. All right, I punched in Mark Twain and Anti-Imperialist League, and they have a listing for American Anti-Imperialist League, and apparently it was established in the U.S. 1898 to battle the American annexation of the Philippines. Earlier versions of this manifest destiny that we've created for ourselves.
Right, and it was the occupation and subjugation of the Philippines that engendered the War Prayer itself.
Okay.
Have you ever read the War Prayer?
Yep, it's been a while, but yeah. It's
breathtaking. In its condemnation of war and warfare, and I remember long ago, back when the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were just young bloodlettings, reading that on the air and being condemned roundly by the little right wingers who listened, because if I recall correctly, Preston, I read it without telling them who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And only after, you don't love America. Well, I guess neither did Mark Twain, huh? It's like explaining to a conservative in Alabama exactly who Helen Keller was. You know, since she's on the back of the Alabama State Quarter.
Yeah.
You know, First Lady of Courage. Well, she was also a socialist, folks. While you're out there demonizing poor, pitiful, little moderate Barack Obama for being a socialist. Ah, the lady, that First Lady of Courage on the back of your quarters one, too.
Yep. And she was a mystic of sorts, too. She hung out with some mystics and, people on a kind of a spiritual quest that's very different from what they define as Christianity, for sure. But I just found a Twain remark. He was he wrote in the New York Herald in 1900 about this unfair treaty. I've read carefully the Treaty of Paris. I have seen that we do not intend to free, but to subjugate the people of the Philippines. We have gone there to conquer, not to redeem. It should, it seems to me, be our pleasure and duty to make those people free and let them deal with their own domestic questions in their own way. And so I am an anti-imperialist. I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land. So.
And just think of how much grief would have been saved had anybody bothered to listen.
Yeah. And we still, though, learn to listen, and I guess we have dozens of military bases there still, and always when we plant these bases, this kind of rough, alienating, the sex industry seems to follow it as well, and a lot of violence against women. I actually connected with some people on Facebook from the Philippines, and they encouraged me to join a group called Stop the Killing in the Philippines, and they talk about how this so-called war on terror, this war of terror, is manifesting itself throughout the global South, including their country. And, you know, they're seeing activists killed and stuff. You know, people, that blurry line, you know, what's a terrorist and a militant, and, you know, it casts a wide net, it seems, at times. So,
well, you know, a militant, an insurgent, an enemy combatant are all fluid definitions that tend to be anybody we don't like.
Yeah, exactly. And we should, you know, instead of labeling all these other people out there, you know, think about ourselves and what we are, you know. Like you said, we are very much, you know, we're part of this. You know, it's not a thing going on out there.
No, we own this.
Yeah, right.
And you know, as much, it doesn't grieve me that George W. Bush is gone, Preston, but gone he is. And the fact of the matter is, the war's still going, and it's Barack Obama's now. It's the Democratic Congress's now. It is. And yeah, frankly, that means that people who think they're Democrats or progressives or liberals have a heightened duty now,
yeah,
just as we have a heightened duty with regard to the environment. You know, you may have, well, no, I think you were talking to Ferg at the time. Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen talked about the markup of the Waxman-Markey climate bill. There was supposed to be, and I don't know, I haven't seen an update yet, but there was supposed to be a vote in the committee on it to try to get it out of committee before the Memorial Day recess, and it was supposed to happen this evening. And the fact of the matter is, the bill has been, you know, the corporatists and the polluters and the toxifiers have won this round. They have made this what was supposed to be a bill to address critical climate issues into a sham. They've made it into a tarted up, just a tarted up syphilitic mess. But the fact of the matter is, it's the only mess we've got. And if this thing dies in committee, that means two more years go by, Preston, in which we do absolutely nothing about climate change.
Yeah, at least in that segment of our society, I think, you know, while that's so disappointing sometimes and gutless and irrational and all that, there are other segments of society where there is movement taking place. And I think, ironically, some of it's in private industry, or, you know, businesses and stuff are moving on, you know, green chemistry and renewables and stuff like that. I was pleasantly surprised. I was watching the local Fox affiliate, the TV news, and they had a segment on how a 10-year-old girl, I forgot where she was, maybe California, was diagnosed with breast cancer recently and had to have a mastectomy.
Oh, that's horrifying.
So, yeah. So I think, you know, people are getting a little scared, and fear can be a great motivator. And instead of letting Hannity and those guys, you know, redirect our attention and our concerns and our emotional energy to, you know, the brown people that he hates so much, we can, you know, look more closely at the real issues.
One hopes.
And, yeah. It's
but by the same token, there are places where where we've got to have government action. And the Markey-Waxman bill, you know, it's got $10 billion of corporate coal welfare in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I keep repeating that number. Oh, God, he's going to go off on that again. But the fact of the matter is, it's there. It is a howling waste of money, and we could absolutely reinvent Appalachia on that $10 billion. But it ain't going to go to the reinvention of Appalachia. It's going to go to further an advertising campaign for the tasty cyanide or fat-free lard, because that's what clean coal is, and that's what carbon capture is. It's so stupid, because of the facts around it that aren't even in dispute, like when Shell Oil says, you know, look, none of this can be deployed before 2050. Well, by then, every scientist of any credibility whatsoever agree, they all agree, that by 2050, it's too late. There really is such a thing as too late.
And tipping points and feedback loops and stuff.
Exactly.
Like that,
exactly. You know?
But, and yes, and again, I share your, you know, yeah, I share that about that and the frustration. But back to government's role, there is that segment of the government, for instance, you know, we know how we haven't signed on to Kyoto. And we put up all these gases and, you know, we're given the big FU to the rest of the world. Still, on the other hand, at the state government level, there's been some movement for sure. In fact, some of these governors' conferences have people like Robert Redford speak, or they go to Sundance and watch, you know, documentaries and have real discussions. And at the state level, they've actually exceeded the Kyoto Treaty suggestions for cutting back and, you know, and to make plans for future cutbacks and also to put in more mass transit and so on and so forth. So, and again, it falls way short, but, you know, just to, it's another part of the story, though, of what, of government, where it's failing, but also where it does succeed. I was amazed. I had this really obscure documentary on sprawl and the whole issue of how much energy that creates. Another real security threat, you know, 45,000 people a year die in car accidents, hundreds of thousands injured, millions of animals being just steamrolled, losing all this farmland and on and on and on. Huge expense, totally massive expense. You know, they only worry about the big massive expenditures if it's something like Medicare or Social Security.
Right.
But road building, you know, like the Roman Empire, they're big into roads, 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 more roads. But anyway, I was watching this documentary, and Mayor Hickenlooper of Denver is in it, making a really thoughtful comment. And they're talking to city planners who are really, they're there. They're talking stuff that the, you know, auto industrial complex does not want thought about. And again, I don't want to completely be negative on the car culture. I think cars can be very useful and in many ways and all that. But again,
and they can be really, really cool too.
Yes, all that. And there's some great roads and all that. But still, again, I think it's in some sort of healthcare field, like holistic medicine or something like that, that says the difference between the cure and the disease is often dose. And I think we've overdosed on the car culture and the way we.
Well, sure we are. And, you know, you remind me of something, Preston, while I was sitting in the doctor's office on Monday, having this sort of Twilight Zone, Outer Limits experience actually watching the Glenn Beck program. He was making a mockery over, you know, California's budget troubles, and he had some right-wing clown from the Orange County Register on, and he made some comment about the fact that the people of California, well, they just recently passed a measure of $10 billion for a train that nobody's going to ride. And the guy said, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then he agreed with Beck, and Beck said, because you know how it is. Everyone else says, well, those schlubs, they'll go and ride the train, and I'll keep driving my car.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I'm sitting there, I'm watching this, and pardon me, Preston, I mean, I'm not barking at you. I was looking at Glenn Beck, just, you know, hard to keep my mouth shut. It's a doctor's office, so I try to behave. But, you know, I was just, you simple sod, you silly bastard. Nobody will ride it. You know, he doesn't even know enough history, Preston, to know that there was rapid transit, mass transit in Southern California before the car culture developed. That mass transit was taken out behind taken out in the alley and killed for the sake of highways and the auto industry.
Yeah, and I think it was Firestone and Standard Oil conspired to decimate that transportation system.
Yeah, I mean, the death of mass transit in Southern California even finds its way into Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
There was a fascinating discussion of this stuff on C-SPAN, about 3 weeks ago. It was hosted, organized by AARP, you know, American Association of Retired People.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a person who looks into transportation issues, because as we age, it's become, that's another problem with being so dependent on cars. It's mobility issues for so many people who, because of their eyesight or arthritis or whatever, aren't going to be able to drive. Young people as well, they're limited by car dependency. But anyway, they had a discussion with a couple authors who looked at the auto system. And I think this is going to be a growing discussion as well. It's not there yet, but I think it's going to be kind of like there's a growing discussion about agriculture right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, community design very much so, then the transportation is going to increase. But anyway, that whole, the love affair with the car, that was very much, that was started by a PR firm, basically. There's a lot of animosity towards cars because people own the streets, and vendors walking, and bicyclists and horses, and a lot of walking. And there are problems with the horses, their own pollution. But
well, and there are multiple layers of objection. For instance, you live in mountain country, too. You live in Denver. You know that building roads in mountains is no easy feat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great expenditure of money. Well, if I want to go to Charleston, the state capital, it's 50 miles away, and I got to go down a mountain. And it's hard to keep the road in good order.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid we should say anything that offends the coal industry, but the fact of the matter is those howling death wagons that are coal trucks take a nice asphalt road, winding though it may be, take a nice asphalt road and turn it into a rutted gravel cow path in a matter of a couple of years.
Yep.
Because they're not designed to carry them. So here I am, you know, I like my vehicle, and, you know, living where I do, there's no mass transit. You know, it's either my feet, a bicycle, and you know, again, the coal trucks, that's begging for, you know, to die, or drive. And so I get out on the road, and, you know, people run off road by coal trucks, people killed by coal trucks, terrorize. My wife shuts her eyes and grabs the dashboard every time one's coming toward us.
Yeah.
It's that terrifying.
Yeah, it's a very intimidating system. In fact, they, you know, kind of market it towards some people. You know, you get the Hummer so you can intimidate others, and if there's a wreck, they'll be totally smashed, but you'll be okay. I mean, there's a whole sick mindset right there. Have a little concern for your neighbor, other people on the road. You know, that's never, don't think about that. Think, again, it's that same theme, your security. What you do to others, don't even think about it.
Nope.
It's you. And, you know, and if it reflects in foreign policy so often, well, they threaten us. We're not going to worry about how the Hummer of our foreign policy is steamrolling these people, treating them like roadkill, collateral damage. You know, let's wipe off the fender. Let's charge them for the dent they left on the fender.
Right.
Oh, a couple other people of that anti-imperialist league. A few other names. John Dewey, the philosopher. Samuel Gompers, labor leader. William James, the psychologist writer. Here's a name that kind of surprised me, though. Andrew Carnegie, the industrialist. I don't know what his motivation may have been, because certainly he made a lot of money through selling steel to the U.S. Navy. Again, one of these totally unfree markets, total state economy, buying steel for the, you know, through the government for war making.
Yes.
But there's other parts of Carnegie. Again, he's a mix too. I'm glad he invested in public libraries. That was Carnegie, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you know.
But he also, you know, some of that was a change of heart as he got older and sort of began hearing the bat wings of hell fluttering around his ears.
Okay.
You know, by the same way that a feudal baron would endow a church to pray for his tormented soul in purgatory ever after.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good story, though. Changes of heart can happen in some unlikely places. And one last name, I think I definitely want to mention, who was among this anti-imperialist league, Jane Addams, who was someone I really didn't know anything about real recent, just a couple of years ago. But she was the first woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And I have a quote from her. I have to kind of fiddle around my computer for a moment, if you'll indulge me.
Absolutely. I can more than happily.
A guy in Maine's been doing this Americans Who Tell the Truth series, and he paints portraits of figures who we may have, I don't know, we may be familiar with, but may have been forgotten, and he's trying to kind of, you know, remind us. And he has the James Adams photo or portrait, and has a little biography about her, and a quote from her where she says, "Much of the insensibility and hardness of the world is due to the lack of imagination, which prevents a realization of the experience of other people." And it's amazing what she accomplished. She was also a founding member of the American Civil Liberties Union and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. You know, two groups that Rush Limbaugh quite regularly goes after, even though he was assisted by the ACLU when he wanted to keep his medical records private. Total hypocrite, on top of everything else. Complete and utter hypocrite. I think that was the one sin that Jesus really couldn't stand. And of course the NAACP, his argument there is, well, they should support Idi Amin. He's a colored person. They're constantly invoking. This is where a lot of people get tripped up. They have these rhetorical devices they use.
Yes. Look, Preston, they work hard on these rhetorical devices.
Yep.
They pour vast funds into them. They support the organizations that create them. Grover Norquist, that crazy tax outfit that he's with. He's become wealthy beyond his wildest dreams on that.
Mm-hmm.
He's never worked a job. He's never produced anything. He's never built anything. He's done nothing but go out and advocate against popularly led government. I mean, the guy is a complete drone on society, and yet yet we are told by the for-profit media that this is the guy to listen to.
Yeah.
Now, this is the guy who said he wanted government weakened to the point that it could be drowned in a bathtub.
Yep. And he's fortunate that he doesn't get challenged very often. I did see him in one forum, though. A lot of Marquist and Rush and a lot of them, on top of the rhetorical techniques, there's a whole delivery that they've practiced and thought a lot about.
Yes.
And it's like, sound authoritative, even when you're completely full of crap.
Right. If you're sitting there babbling nonsense words, America once in a while, and flag,
ladies and gentlemen.
Sound authoritarian.
Yes. That kind of thing. Well, Norquist got challenged. I forgot where I saw it. Maybe on some forum on C-SPAN. I don't know. But you could tell he started shaking. And it reminded me of Limbaugh when he got challenged in a studio. He had that complete meltdown when they don't want him in front of a live studio audience. And this woman was giving him...
Down the road?
Yep. About his homophobia, how he cultivates homophobic attitudes, and he had a total meltdown. So it's fragile, it's interesting how it works. They're very much Humpty Dumpty characters. You know, they're up there, they get lofted up there, I don't know.
But the funny thing is, unlike Humpty Dumpty, when Rush Limbaugh fell, all the king's horses and all the king's men came, and by God, they did put Humpty back together again.
To a degree, but not completely. I do. He's losing listeners. He's losing. They're having a crisis of credibility in some ways.
Well, if you've got any kind of faith in the American people at all, you got to figure that at some point, after arguing in favor of this stuff for 25 years, we spent the last 8 years doing exactly what Rush Limbaugh wanted. And look where we are. And at some point, his ability to lie around his responsibility for this, people see through it. Or at least some people do. You know, that hardcore little cancerous knot of dead-enders and ne'er-do-wells and 20-percenters and loyal Bushies. They're a case of there's none so blind as those who will not see.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. I very much want to hear what your other callers, what's on their mind, but before I let you go, another comment from Jane Addams. We must also remember that peace has come to mean a larger thing. It is no longer merely absence of war, but the unfolding of life processes which are making for a common development. Peace is not merely something to hold congresses about. It has come to be a rising tide of moral feeling, which is slowly engulfing all pride of conquest and making war impossible. So that was her vision. We're certainly way far from that, but an important vision, at least to have out there, you know, something that's hidden from us.
Yes.
And also beyond a vision of reality of something that's been organized in your neck of the woods, actually. I wanted to make sure you knew about this. I just befriended this wonderful lady at, West Virginia or West Virginia State, and she posted on Facebook this event she's going to be attending called the Kanawha Valley.
Kanawha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kanawha Valley Sustainability Fair in Charleston, West Virginia, May 30th.
And I've been made aware of it, and we're going to try to be down there for that.
Oh, that would be great.
It feels a little, because, this is the kind of microscope I keep myself under. I feel a little hypocritical, burning all that gasoline to get down there to do this, but...
Yeah, life is so full of those paradoxes, and that's another thing that the right wing, they'll know that we're going to have these contradictions in our lives.
Why didn't you drive your electric car?
There you go. Hey, that phone is made of oil, too, so give up your phone and da-da-da.
Yeah, and usually it's a coal reference around here, Preston. Look at all them hippies over there. Why don't they do this in the dark? Coal keeps the lights on.
Go live in the cave
Yeah.
And again, we don't have the opportunity where we can sit around and say, okay, how do we... respond. What they're doing is like a role playing of sorts.
Yes.
There
are literally flyers in these guys' paychecks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, have you ever seen one of those in your payday? Remember, you can sign the little flyer, it's time to re-up your contribution to the United Way, that kind of stuff. Well, people who work for sleazy coal companies get flyers in their paychecks. Remember, the environmentalists hate your children and want them to go hungry and get on the welfare.
Mm-hmm.
I made that remark in that that essay I wrote recently about building a sacred zone in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
About the fact that people who work for most of these mountain removal operations don't have a union to protect them. They are absolutely defenseless against the company. They can't complain if they are bombarded every day with propaganda. Of course, then again, there's Cecil Roberts, the head of the United Mine Workers, and he's a propagandist for coal, too. And since the UMWA has a handful of members on mountain removal operations, all of a sudden the UMWA thinks mountain removal is the neatest thing since sliced bread.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's grievous to me, and more importantly, it's grievous to a lot of retired United Mine Workers. They see it as an absolute perversion of their union and a betrayal of everything that the union is supposed to stand for.
Yeah.
Not Cecil.
Yep.
You know, because Cecil gets out there and tells the same lies about climate science that Don Blankenship does. Those two can't agree on what day it is if they're looking at the same calendar, but they can agree that all the scientists are lying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we were talking about authors and the political roles that they play at times, specifically Twain. But in the contemporary period, there have been people, some reactionary authors, like Michael Crichton. I mean, you want to talk about setting back the discussion on climate change. Wasn't it his book?
Yes. I can't remember the book, but it was Michael Crichton.
And it was very much, it compared scientists talking about global warming to, like, Nazi, you know, doctors. Just hysterical attacking people who were talking about climate change. And it sold hundreds of thousands of copies, and it became a real.
It's a bigger work of fiction than anything he ever penned.
Yeah.
Didn't he go on to his long home recently? Didn't he go to his reward?
He did. Yeah. But I think also, though, in the contemporary period, we have remarkable people like Barbara Kingsolver.
Oh, I love her. I love her.
Name, Kingsolver, perfect. And she was interviewed by The Progressive several years ago, and she was great. She was she's like, that's right, I'm a left-wing commie, and I do want to change the world. And most recently, she's applying that spirit to the sustainable agriculture movement. Her whole family, I think.
I heard her interviewed about that not too long back, and it was absolutely fascinating.
Okay.
Well, no, yeah, it was too long back. It was over a year ago, but I heard her on one of the NPR programs and talking about, you know, the sustainability garden that she had. I think, yeah, that she had and her family had pulled together on their land, and it was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she is another. And Michael Pollan, of course. I don't. The Eater's Manifesto, or whatever I believe is the title, or In Defense of Food. In Defense of Food, that's what it was. That book has recently been released in paperback. And I encourage anybody to read anything that Michael Pollan puts out, because there's no more thoughtful writer out there considering the implications of culture at present. I got an email, I mentioned that Sacred Zone essay I wrote not too long back, and I got a response on it today, and it was a really beautiful thing. I got a response from a gentleman at the University of Vermont, and he just wrote to me and said, thanks for your great work. And he said, look out for an article coming out in a new journal, Solutions, edited by David Orr, Paul Hawken, Wes Jackson, and others. And I know you keep an eye on things like this. New journal, Solutions. You probably want to keep an eye out for that, Preston. He says, we will be outlining a new design for Appalachia, as you referred to in your article. And he's, and this is the cool part. He says, we'll also be needing help of Appalachian communities in designing a new vision, starting out with the question, what do you want Appalachia to become? And I wrote him back thanking him for writing me, because it was inspiring to hear from him, because he's one of those scientists that I called for in the article to begin begin the work. He refers me also to an article at the Buckminster Fuller website called Comprehensive Design for a Carbon-Neutral World, The Challenge of Appalachia. And I can't wait to read that.
Because
Appalachia presents problems. And just as our friend Jeff Biggers has noted, the number of good things that have come out of Appalachia, if we can solve our climate problems in Appalachia, everything else is easy. This is the hardest place to address issues of climate in the United States. And if we can solve the Appalachian question, if we can solve the Appalachian problem, if we can solve coal in Appalachia, then everything else is a no-brainer. And I wish I could somehow communicate to people the truth of that. You know, we don't have to solve coal in a place that doesn't have coal. You know, those are coal-fired power plants and things like that. But if we show in Appalachia that we can have wind and solar and that it can absolutely transform this region, everybody has no choice but to look up and say, "Dadgum, look what they just did." And it can happen. And we've got to consider all, you know, you mentioned that sustainability fair, and I mentioned driving down the mountain. We've got to consider all facets of it, Preston. We've got to talk about how people get around in Appalachia, because, you know what? We don't have any rail to speak of. The Cardinal, Amtrak's Cardinal, runs from D.C. Through West Virginia, past the Greenbrier, down the New River, down to through Montgomery, down to Charleston, to Huntington, and then boom, gone. And that's the only passenger rail in West Virginia. And it was frustrating to me when I saw the layout of President Obama's rail plan, that there's this massive plan for a redo of the whole Acela corridor, you know, the D.C. to Boston thing. But then it hits the West Virginia border, bupkis. No plans to upgrade, no plans to expand, no plans for a spur that might run Charleston, that might run from Charleston to the Clarksburg and Morgantown, or a spur that would run Morgantown to Beckley. None of that is there.
Okay.
And we've got, and that's one of those questions we have to answer about Appalachia, is this, again, and it's one of those things that if we solve the problem here, it's solved everywhere else, because this is about the hardest place in America to do transportation. Because whatever you do, whether it's a road or a railroad or a monorail or a hiking path, you got to go over something, around something, under something, or through something.
Mm-hmm.
Point A is not in a line of sight with point B.
Yep. Well, one of the approaches we've been taking here in Denver recently, I noticed something called car sharing for people who still can utilize a car but don't need one all the time. You know, I mean, and again, we're Hannity and Limbaugh and the rest of them, where are they focusing our minds? They're focusing our minds on taxes. But they don't have nary a word, certainly not a negative word, to say about ever-increasing consumer, kind of necessary consumer expenditures. They'd say, "Oh no, that's choice. You have choice in the market." No, they've got these inelastic. They're called inelastic markets, where if you want your job, you want to be able to get to it, you're going to have to get in a car, which means you're going to have to get.
Yeah, or if you or and it extends past that, Preston. If you want to make X number of dollars and go buy the nice clothes for your family, then you've got to compromise yourself and go to work for some corporation.
Yeah.
That's going to ask you to compartmentalize your life, where you spend 8 hours a day doing evil, and you come home and try to feel good about the other 16 hours of the day.
Yep. You know, so infrequently, you know, when we talk about our jobs, it's like, "Oh, what do you do? How much do you make?" kind of thing. And not, you know, is it good work? Because
right.
Rarely is it.
Oh, by the way, our buddy Marty writes in, Preston. He says, Crichton hadn't written anything at all decent since Westworld. His other worthy novel is, of course, The Andromeda Strain. Other than that, Crichton was a hack, and the book to which we've been referring without knowing the title is State of Fear.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. And it became like a, you know, very much a touchstone of anti, you know, global warming talk, chit-chat. You know, it'd be like, "Well, you know what Crichton says, da da da," and they all learn particular catchphrases from the book. But anyway, you know, back to, you know, dealing with transportation. So car shares beginning here. Also, I noticed there's this new bike sharing thing going on. They're setting up these spots. They did it in Paris. I think that was the first place. Then Portland started doing it. Now in Denver, they've got a pilot program going where they have these bikes located at different points, like by light rail stations or at the city and county building. People can use their card, get it, take it to the next stop, drop it off, whatever. So there's that going on. But again, it's so important to believe that we can do it. Again, a lot of the psyops is resistance is futile, but don't give it up, you know.
You will be assimilated, yes.
Right. And I found a beautiful response to that kind of attitudinal warfare that they do, the propaganda. An article on the Huffington Post called Where There's a Will, There's a Won't. And he starts talking about this article by George Will, and he's the person always saying no can do, the will where there's a won't.
I sat in the doctor's office on Monday and read a 6-month-old essay by George Will. I had this combination of Glenn Beck and George Will and being a little nervous about the thing getting carved out of my hide. I was a wreck by the time I left. I think I even ripped the George Will article out and tucked it in my pocket because something about it just made me crazy and I wanted to share it with everyone. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. These are wonderful conversations.
But there again, he's teaching particular snarky attitudes. And I'll just post this on your Facebook page or something because I think you'll I think you'll enjoy it. One of his paragraphs, the foremost psychological tragedy of our time is that the people, I'll just let you read it. I'll just pass it along to you. Where there's a will, there's a won't on Huffington Post. And did you happen to catch Colbert's piece on Hannity? Hannity did this bit with these graphics like he's talking to second graders. And sadly, you know, a lot of people have only gotten about that much of an education, formal education.
Yeah. And I noticed that out of Glenn Beck, too. It's like listening to a psychotic anarcho-Randian Mr. Rogers.
Yes. Well put. There you go.
So I don't guess I saw the Colbert bit, but...
So Hannity did this thing about the tree of... And then socialism coming out of the apple, and then the rotten apple of socialism, and on and on and on. And Colbert just took it from there with their own graphics.
Picked it up, yeah. And he's they're so good at that.
Quickly, some sad news. I was speaking with Bob Jr. about this. Some of the kids, some of the youth really being, absorbing a lot of, Glenn Beck madness type stuff. And, he told me about an incident of a kid he knows shooting paintball through the school and breaking computers and stuff.
Right.
We had a kid here in Denver, a 13-year-old, a couple days ago, shot and killed his 5-year-old brother and attacked his mom. Didn't kill her, but wounded her grievously. What sort of modeling are they receiving? Toxins are they receiving in their air, food, and water, and in their media?
Yes, absolutely.
But anyway, I... one last comment, then I'll let you go.
Go ahead, sure. No worries.
I hope you make it to that sustainability fair. But I also want to mention that the same person that alerted me of that fair also mentioned that the movie Occupation 101 had been showed at Marshall University.
Yes.
Is that the same from the movie We Are Marshall?
Yes, same place.
Okay, and that's in West Virginia?
Yeah, Huntington.
Huntington, okay.
And so, interestingly, it's also the site, I think it's still under consideration, One of the banks that took tons of bailout money, their CEO or whatever he is, endowed a few million dollars on Marshall to build a center for the study of the free markets, and he's endowing some sort of Ayn Rand chair in economics.
Oh, no. They're here in Boulder at the University of Colorado. They're trying to endow a chair of conservatism or something. You know, if they do, you know, it should be like Jim Hightower said, that these people are sponsored by corporations. They should have to wear those race car driver suits.
Yeah, exactly, with the little logos all over them.
Exactly. And it was, speaking of race car drivers, Dale Earnhardt Jr. And you can, you know, Google Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Michael Moore or something like that. And he was the one who did recommend that his crew all go see Fahrenheit 9/11. And so Marshall, just against expanding the story, I knew the Marshall football story, but now I know, you know, this chair is being built. But also there are people at Marshall who are doing free showings of these great documentaries. So we're everywhere. There's little progressive activity everywhere. There's a sociologist who calls people like us cultural creatives, and he's talking about a demographic of people who have been involved in some sort of solidarity group, or maybe a fair trade project or labor, or maybe they contribute to alternative media or practice alternative health care, are respectful of different cultures, and they live that and they share it in some ways through their lives. And he calls these figures cultural creatives, and he estimates that there are about 50 million of those sorts of people here in the U.S., probably 60 million in Europe. And he's like, you know, but it doesn't see itself as a movement. You know, Limbaugh and others, they can constantly rally their communities, but we don't, very rarely do we have the same sort of chances to see ourselves and see our strengths and our numbers and our diversity and our successes. But they are taking place. And something else he said that struck me was that he said in the Global South, you also see cultural creatives. He hasn't done the same number crunching, but the networks that they've got in places like the Philippines are just remarkable. And even though they've got very little in terms of resources, just the way they connect, just little connections here and there, make huge differences and create these positive tipping points. You know, the tipping points aren't only regarding, you know, climate catastrophes. There are tipping points regarding social change movements as well. And, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has been writing about this stuff.
I agree, and that's what makes it so damnably frustrating for me to see, you know, the desperate financial straits that so many grassroots organizations are in. You might recall last fall, I attended something called the Brushy Fork Institute in Berea, Kentucky, at Berea College. It was fascinating. It was instructive and informative and energizing. And sadly, I recently got notification that they have installed a new study track for next year's Brushy Fork Institute in helping grassroots community-based nonprofits simply stay alive. Because a lot of organizations are funded by, you know, they're all nonprofits, and they're funded by larger granting foundations. The foundations all had their money in the stock market.
Yeah.
You know, where else are you? Yeah, we don't have any other place to stick your money and hopefully get some sort of return on it. Some sort of meaningful return beyond that of inflation. And so these agencies have been absolutely slain by the predators. This whole little theory that has been foisted on us, that somehow what happened on Wall Street was, you know, it was terrible and the people on Wall Street are suffering so much. Bull. That money didn't just disappear. Money doesn't disappear unless it's not real in the first place. Somebody got rich.
Yeah. And in that field, it's hard to see. It's very much on the margins, but community banking kind of movement. Credit unions have gotten more popular.
Mm-hmm.
Alternative currencies. I read an article recently on the growth of bartering recently. Someone wrote to me about some credit union that was going to focus its investments on green energy stuff. But, yeah, it's such a struggle. I was so disappointed myself recently to learn that one of my favorite magazines, and it seemed to, had like a couple hundred thousand subscribers. It was getting some good publicity on, like, the Sundance Channel, and it folded, like, 4 months ago. And it was called Plenty. It kind of reminded me of when...
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar, yeah.
Okay, that folded. And, it was kind of like when Hope folded, weren't enough subscribers, sadly. But here, just tonight, there's something else germinating. What you said, something about a magazine called Solutions, maybe.
Right, right.
So I'm seeing that. I see where we lose things, and a lot is being lost. But there's always this other thing that's popping up over there. Something brand new, actually. Like, we lost Betsy Rosenberg, who did this radio show called Eco Talk on Air America Radio, like every Saturday, Sunday. Fantastic program. Wonderful woman. She'd speak with all these pioneering people in green chemistry and social entrepreneuring and all this stuff. And she just could not get... She did have allies from, like, Robert Kennedy and the Natural Resource Defense Council, stuff like that, but still, there just wasn't the energy.
Well, there's allies, and see, Preston, I've seen this a million times if I've seen it once. Okay, not a million, but enough to make it feel like a million. How we define allies is another one of those things that we have to look at. I've had situations where people say, oh, that's great what you're doing there with your little radio station, Bob. We'll be, oh, yeah, I'm glad you came to talk to us. We'll be happy to provide you with guests for interviews.
And that's something.
That's like a man dying of thirst being offered a peanut butter sandwich.
You know, I think it's something, but there's so much more. I mean, that's.
But we don't. But we seem to not understand, Preston. I promise I'm not going to turn this into a funding pitch. But we seem not to understand on our side, and it's not just me, okay? Guy James has been down this road. Boss Man Wayne has been down this road. We've been down it together. All kinds of people have gone with saying, we're willing to do this. We have the talent, the time, the energy, the dedication, the determination, the grit, the gumption. We can do this. We can take back some part of the field of battle and quit ceding all of this ground to the right wing.
Yeah.
And what
yeah.
we get is, it's like that gag from Blazing Saddles. What we get is a Laurel and Hardy handshake.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
because I don't know if it's because we don't move in the right circles, we eat the wrong brand of caviar, drive the wrong car, smell funny, don't have a designer necktie on. I don't know what it is, but our side, that's wonderful what you're doing there. You keep the fight up, Bob.
Right, right.
And you look at him and go, yeah. I can't.
Right.
I'm not independently wealthy. If I was independently wealthy, I wouldn't be bothering you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, I think it's the product of some attitudinal manipulation that's been going on, where things like solidarity and, people being serious about where they're putting their dollars. I've asked so many union people to... invest something in radio, progressive radio, partake in progressive radio, and it's just like, no. And they're, they get their asses kicked on this public forum day in and day out. The teachers union.
Rick Smith was on, and, he's a member of organized labor and does a brilliant job every weekend, but can't crack the nut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, people aren't, they aren't engaging there. They aren't committing themselves there in these info wars in public spaces. They are accessible, these local shows.
But, you know,
and
just
then,
because,
and
just because,
wise.
Yeah, just because Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann and Ed Schultz are out there on the TV box now, they think we got them licked.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. I don't know. I'm speculating. But it's frustrating as the day is long.
And that's an improvement. I mean, again.
Oh, sure it is.
Positive.
No. I'm not being critical.
But, yeah. But and that same kind of disengagement is there money-wise. You know, it's, you know, people who have told me, oh, I can't afford that. You know, it's like magazine subscriptions or something. But a $1,500 10-speed bike, I don't know, to race for races, you know, not to go to work, but 100 miles. You know, and that's fine. People can have their thing. But again, there's some investments that should be being made that aren't being made. But again, I began to say we lost, you know, Betsy Rosenberg's Eco Talk, but a brand new program. And I think at that scale and really well done, just started up on the Sundance channel, and it's called Eco Trip, The Real Cost of Living. And their episode last Tuesday, they were in Appalachia. I'm not sure. I came into it kind of late, but I'm almost positive it was West Virginia. And he was speaking to people, real people on the ground, the activists there. And then from there, you know, where the coal's coming from, he went to a company or a government, something that's creating the new light bulbs. And he talked about compact fluorescence, but he also talked about LEDs, you know, how much better they are. And I don't know, the whole show kind of really, it was really good and informative, angering at points, but also inspiring. So, yeah, I think you might be able to, it's probably on webs and all that stuff, Sundance Channel, Eco Trip.
Okay, I will look for it.
I think you'll enjoy it. And, you know, at least that guy, you know, it can happen. There's some money floating around out there. There are serious investments being made. And I'm still confident you will find the people you need, you know, to accomplish what you, you know.
Well, it's just so incredibly difficult to imagine success. We just want to survive. You know, I was thinking about it some. You know, we talk about where we ought to be and where we ought to be going, and I think it was a conversation with Albert in the last couple of weeks where he said, you know, the horn needs to be, and he just ticked off all these foreign other countries. I hate that word, foreign. And I got to thinking, you know, we're talking about Netroots Nation. We're talking about, you know, things that we ought to be covering, things that we ought to be broadcasting to the world. This network, if there's one thing we should be broadcasting to the world, it's the Copenhagen Climate Conference in December in, curiously enough, Copenhagen, Denmark. Trust me when I say that being in frozen Denmark in December ain't my idea of a good time.
Mm-hmm.
There's, I mean, maybe, you know, sure, Aquavit, whatever, but there ain't enough of it to, no. But we should be there.
Yeah, and again, you can hear the naysayers. They'll say, oh, you're flying, there you go. You know, that's how they always go after Gore. Oh, look at him flying around and talk about things, a hypocrite, how dare you do that. But again, I think there's a context in which actions are taking place. You know, we're not against travel. You know, it would be great to have a vision towards dirigibles, you know, that don't need all these fossil fuels. It's good to see New Zealand starting to fuel, at least partially, their jets with biofuels. And
mm-hmm.
Certainly problems with biofuels.
Yeah, as opposed to fueling one's jets with, say, liquid coal.
Right.
From the Fischer-Tropsch method.
Right. But again, it all begins with the criticism. I mean, and we're going to be in these systems that we are critical of for the time being. I mean, here's where we're at. So there are going to be these contradictions. But I think, again, you begin the criticism to try to move it forward and towards something more appropriate. And I think also in a way we can earn, you know, these, you know, expenditures of, you know, fuels and stuff. I mean, doing worthwhile things with it are also, you know, buying what, carbon credits or something, or getting a tree planted, a couple trees planted for the you know, as a thank you to Mother Earth for
for
the fuel. But so anyway, great speaking with you, Bob.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Preston. Always a pleasure. And God willing, and we make it to the sustainability fair, I'll try to have some sort of a little report back on it.
That would be great, definitely.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Calling from Denver, that is, you know, I think we have to say that Preston is the official horn resident optimist. And you know what? When you're dealing with somebody like me, you kind of got to have somebody like Preston, because otherwise, if I didn't have Preston reminding me what's good out there, I might grow a permanent Dick Cheney snarl on my face or something. And trust me, that's a horror I can't comprehend. Hey, Juanita, you still there?
Uh-huh.
Oh, hallelujah. I'm so glad you stuck around.
My leg's about to go to sleep, so I didn't know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, there's an old song that says, the song is ending, but the memory lingers on.
Yes.
Well, right to that great saying by Chavez, Bush is gone, but the sulfur smell is still there.
Yeah, the sulfur smell lingers, yeah.
That man, he got it completely right. He had him. I had the View's been rather good this week.
So I've been told.
Yeah. I don't know whether to start with Jesse Ventura or your guy you had to listen to in the office.
Oh, Glenn Beck.
Did you hear about him being on there?
No.
Well,
that's your job. I don't. I you know.
Well, I heard you talking the other day about him being on the Jesse Ventura, thought.
Yeah, because, well, yeah, I saw that mentioned.
You hear it every once in a while, or somebody tells you.
Yeah, true.
But anyway, see, I haven't heard you all this week every time, you know. I'm just the opposite of you. I had problems getting Firefox. Is it Foxfire?
Firefox.
Yeah, but I didn't have any trouble getting on the one, so maybe they switched us around. They gave you the one that I don't get. But I think it's straightened out now. I had some viruses. But, I mean, I could get Explorer fine. I couldn't even go into my computer because it said I was trying to get into 15 things at one time. But anyhow, well, which one you want me to tell you about first?
I'll start with Glenn Beck. Let's stay with some continuity.
Okay, this is really interesting. He came out, and Barbara said, well, why are you nervous? And he said, well, look at how Whoopi's looking at me. And they had scheduled him before the, what was it, the press club with Obama and Wanda Sykes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, the Washington Correspondents' Dinner.
So what had happened was Barbara and Whoopi went to it, and they had to take a train there. And he was on the train, and Barbara said, well, you have to contend with me, too. We're talking about Whoopi. She said, there's two of us. And she said, we got on the train, and then I heard somebody say, hey, Barbara Walters. And I went over, and we talked. And she said, I was very nice to you. Then they showed what he did on his show on Monday. He said that he and this other man had got on the train and were going to sit down, and they were told they couldn't sit there, that they were reserved. And then he said that You'll be glad to see who it's going to be and all. And so then he saw these police coming, guarding, you know, in. And then he said, I heard, you know, I can't say the way he said it, but he was kind of like, oh, there's Van Beck, you know, like that, imitating Barbara, saying that's the way she talked. And he just had, he just was really, you know, his obnoxious stuff on there. I can't remember all of it. But she said, why did you say that? So that's not the way it happened. And she said, we didn't have any reserve seats. And they didn't get on with any guards either. So they were looking for seats. And she, and Whoopi said, you know, said Barbara didn't talk to you in that tone of voice. Said you were the one that called out to her first. And he said, yeah, that's right. It's kind of like, you know, well, I'm caught, but who cares? I don't care. And so Barbara asked him, said, you're a reporter, aren't you? And he said, oh, no, I'm not a reporter. I'm a commentator. And she said, well, don't you believe in getting your facts straight?
You mean he didn't call himself a rodeo clown this time?
Is that what he calls himself?
Yeah, he calls himself a rodeo clown.
Well, she said that, she told him, she said, well, if you're a commentator, don't you still want to get your facts right? Oh, no, I don't do that. She said, do you mean to tell me that you don't care if your facts are correct or not? And then Whoopi said, what I hate about that is that you absolutely lied. She didn't call it, say you didn't tell the truth. She said, you lied. She was mad. She was sticking her finger in her mouth and everything. Because he wouldn't, he had no dignity about him. It, you know, it's kind of like, caught me in a lie, but so what? I lied.
Yeah, I do all that. I do that all the time. Big deal. And, well, was he doing that smarmy little, hey, that whiny little voice thing he does?
Well, he was more like, not exactly that. He wasn't crying or anything. But the one with Jesse Ventura was great. Did you ever get to see it?
I only read about it, no. I saw him tear apart Brian Kilmeade, and I saw him rip that life support system for a toupee, Sean Hannity. I saw him rip him a new one.
Well, this one was so good because he said so much in such a short time in responding to mostly Elizabeth. He didn't, about time she'd get something out, I mean, he'd just throw water all over it. And she said, she started out saying, what about Nancy Pelosi? But he got in about, well, you know, they're trying to get rid of her. And she said, what about, why didn't they try to get rid of Bush and Cheney when they found out that they lied about getting us into the war? And she said, well, you know, they come back with, well, you know, Hillary Clinton was for it, and this is for it. He said, yeah, I know they're all for it. They're all in it. So that's why they won't do any investigations. And then she said, well, those people, they don't have any qualms about the way they treat us. And he said, well, are we supposed to stoop to their level? You know, he wouldn't tell her she was wrong. He just put the lie on everything. And he said, you know, I'd love to have Nick Cheney and waterboard him for about 10 minutes. And he said, I'd have him confess in Sharon Tate murders. He said that somewhere else, too, but I thought it was great. And then she asked him, hadn't he been waterboarded, you know, when he was in training for the SEALs? And he said, well, it wasn't the SEALs training, it was the Sears thing. And he said, yes, we were all waterboarded. And he said, and yes, it's torture. And she said, well, you know, that they did away with a lot of the things that had been done before, and it was called inquiry, do they call it?
Oh,
instead of torture?
Oh, enhanced interrogation.
And he said, well, that was Dick Cheney just changing one word. And let's see, what else? I mean, he just, there was so many things that he got. I'll tell you where you could find it. Buzzflash. You could see Glenn Beck, too.
Okay.
You might have to.
Oh, I just got an email here. Apparently, it's posted up on the Horn website.
Oh.
So I will see it. I know the Glenn Beck one is.
Well, they're on Buzzflash. You might have to go to the second page. You know, they might not be on page one now. But, you know, it's got the thing where you can go and see all the different ones they've shown. Of the different little clips, like of John Stewart and so forth. And it's got the whole thing on about both of them. And and Barbara said something the other day that was pretty, you know, plain spoken for her, but I forget now what it was about. It was something, I think, about the torture thing and about Nancy Pelosi. But anyway, it was really good. It was really good.
Well, I will see to it that I see it.
Yeah. If you got a Buzzflash, you can. Well, if it's on yours too, but yeah, I don't know how to describe how he was. It's kind of like somebody got caught in a lie, and they don't give a happy. Like, who cares? But y'all were talking about. I mean, Ferg was laughing about what you were talking about.
Yeah, because I was being puerile and juvenile, and I admit it.
Well, I was. I had worked, I had done office work, and I was working at this hospital, and I was just in misery. It was a miserable place to work, the office was. And they couldn't find a cook. They had a problem finding a cook. And I just said, I think I'd like to do that. And so I just asked the administrator. She said, sure. And, of course, they told me, you know, I was putting myself down, you know, a notch and all. I mean, they said, don't you think you've lowered yourself, degraded yourself coming in here? And Baba has so much fun in that place.
Yeah.
And one of the first things we had to do was have to make sandwiches with pita bread. We laughed, and we had more fun about the pita bread. You can just imagine. But see, when I was in the office, there was no laughing. But there, we laughed and laughed. We were working hard, but we were laughing and laughing and laughing. But that was why, so tell him if think about the pita bread.
I will see to it that he hears that. Yeah, he's out of the room right now, but yeah, he'll get
it. But anyway, I'm like you. I was in the doctor's office having some office surgery too. I think Friday, and then I had to go in today and have it seen about. But I'm like you about the stuff that's supposed to make you not feel any pain.
The lidocaine, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. It just, I don't know. I'm just one of those people. They say I'm hard to put to sleep, you know, when I have anesthesia to be knocked out. But I know some people, I'm almost envious of them. They get high on aspirin. But not me.
Wow. Yeah. And, of course, I remember all those Southern ladies from when I was a little boy had an aspirin and a Coca-Cola every day, and it just made it feel so good.
Oh, yeah, that was supposed to get you high.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the Buffering was supposed to, too. It was Buffering and Coke. And, boy, I was trying it, and it didn't work.
Yeah, well, see, nobody told those little old ladies that they took the cocaine out of Coca-Cola in the, you know, like late 1890s or early 1900s.
Well, I've heard some people say they get high off a cigarette. I never did get high off them. I used to smoke. And I was habited to it, but it didn't make me feel good.
No,
if anything. I just had to have them.
Right.
But, you know, so different people are different ways. But why don't you ask your doctor, is he so crazy about the right wing? Is he right wing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's a good guy, though. I mean, I know why he is the way he is. And, you know,
yeah.
And we go in and he does his doctrine and I do my patienting and we joust while we do it.
Is he the same one that's been taking care of you?
Yeah, for a while. Yeah, a couple of years now.
Yeah, he sounds like a good doctor. I think I finally got a pretty good one, too.
He's actually a physician's assistant, but I've gotten to the point where I trust him more than any MD that I know around here.
Yeah, some of them are great. They really are.
Because he actually gives a damn. And that just goes a real long way with me.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Well, Juanita, well, I'm going to wander on.
Yeah, let you go and yeah, tell your son about the pita bread. And
I will.
Just use his own imagination.
He'll giggle. I know he will.
It was funny.
His 13-year-old sense of humor is fully functioning and always
well, that's
armed.
What we had in, when we were cooking, you know, we just act like a bunch of kids, you know, we had a big time, good time. And, you know, cooking is very creative, too.
Oh, gosh, yes.
That's another thing I loved about it. I like office work for a while, but then after a while, you know, it's so boring. But cooking is the never-ending creation.
Yeah, it's never quite the same.
Yep. Okay.
All right, you take care, Juanita.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
View correspondent Juanita calling from Central Florida. About 18 minutes left in the program before we wrap it up for this Thursday night edition. I do believe in having some fun. And frankly, watching a little bit of misery on the side, cat fighting on the right wing is always pleasurable. And this time, you know, it's like those Saturday morning cartoons when you were a kid when Batman would meet Superman. Ooh, you know. Well, this is kind of the antimatter version of that. I guess that qualifies as our obligatory Star Trek reference of the night. Apparently, Michael the Savage Wiener. Da-da-da. Wiener. Michael the Savage Wiener is really angry with Flush Flemball. And you're going to enjoy this. He's not allowed to travel to Britain, and he's yeah, I'll sue, I tell you, I'll sue. And he's trying to milk this for all the publicity and PR he can get. And this is the latest thing by turning on his fellow right-wing yammerheads. It's precious.
And yet here in America, I've had some people come to my aid. They see the bigger picture. They're not like O'Reilly. They're not like Limbaugh, who's the biggest disappointment of all. Limbaugh has turned out to be the biggest phony of all of them. Amongst all of them, he is the biggest fraud. Rush Limbaugh is a fraud. When he was accused of the drug usage, I supported him. But that man is a one-way street. It's all about him. He's in it for nobody but himself.
God bless Media Matters. And interesting that the Savage Wiener just had that light go on for him. Really? Have you met Sean Hannity yet? I mean, we're talking about egos that are barely able to be contained within the space of the planet itself. Yeah, the Savage Wiener. Limbaugh is a fraud. You know what? Maybe we ought to make a soundbite out of that. Every time we play a Rush Limbaugh clip, we'd have to play the Savage Wiener. Limbaugh is a fraud. If I can remember, if I've got the presence of mind for it, maybe I'll try to do that. Now, as we head toward the end of the evening, now that's your fun, that's your giggle. This would be funny if it weren't for the fact that it's so damn tragic. It's the story of Sheila Moos, M-U-H-S, yes, Moos. Naturally, this story arises in Texas. The story of Sheila Moos and her husband, Gail Moos. And I mean, we're talking about some real live, sure enough, winners. They're proud, proud people, them Moos. I think if you were named Moos, you'd kind of have to it should be state law or federal law that you have to own cattle. Never mind.
proud defenders of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And they had their house out there in Texas. And above their house, they flew a rebel flag. Always proud. Proud. They had him a hand-lettered sign, looked like Jethro Bodine himself had writ it, painted it. And it said, "Trespassers will be shot. Survivors," that's S-U-R-V-I-V-E-R-S, "survivors will be reshot. Smile, I will." I'm thinking that should be smile, period, I will. But since there's two of them, it should probably be smile, period, we will. But never mind. If you go over to Jonathan Turley's blog, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N-T-U-R-L-E-Y, jonathanturley.org, and look for, look around, you'll find this. The photos are just, you understand why survivors is spelled S-U-R-V-I-V-E-R-S. Trespassers will be shot. Survivors will be reshot. Smile, I will. In Texas, of course, the law is clear. You can use deadly force in defense of property. Most other states of the union do not allow that. Not quite as bad as Florida, where merely being made a little bit nervous is a defense to outright murder. But still, they live near a lake in Texas. And I guess there was a levee or some such. And one day recently, some folks driving down the road, including a gentleman by the name of Donald Coffee Sr., a 5-year-old named Destiny Coffee, were out off-roading, and they stopped because they had kids with them, and the kids had to pee. Just did. Well, that's when Sheila Moose and Gail Moose, her husband, decided to defend their rights. They got out the family shotguns, 12-gauge. Shotgun, I'm sorry, just one. Now, bear in mind, there is no evidence that anyone was on the Moose property. They opened fire. Sheila Moose, age 45, fired one round at the little group, the little family. She handed the shotgun to her husband, Gail Moose, and he fired another round. One of those rounds killed 7-year-old Donald Coffee Jr., as well as seriously wounding Patrick Kamick, 30 years old, a family friend. Wounded in the attack were Destiny Coffee, 5 years old. Donald Coffee Sr. was wounded. Bear in mind, this is a 12-gauge shotgun, and I know a little something about 12-gauge shotguns. One of the reasons that I won't go spring gobbler hunting, turkey hunting, in West Virginia is because we have this crazy-ass law that even folks in Alabama think is crazy.
that says you can use what we refer to around here as a rifle gun to hunt turkeys. Now, bear in mind, the spring gobbler season is when you wear all the camo you can find, all the camouflage you wear, and you don't move, and you try to be as invisible as possible because turkeys are relatively smart birds. And you sit real still and you use a hen call, and you try to call in a gobbler close enough that you can take your preferably shotgun and get your turkey. But a lot of idiots around here see a turkey at 300 yards through a 14-power scope and shoot him with a rifle. Now, the problem that arises out of that is that, again, you get a bunch of idiots in the woods who shoot at anything that moves, a rustle in the bushes or whatever. And if you generally, if you get a load of, you know, number four shot in the back, you're going to hurt like hell, but you can survive it. But if you get a 22 mag round or a 222 round, it doesn't go in. It goes all the way through and tears the hell out of it and cancel Christmas. It's not at all unusual every spring to have a fatality or two from spring gobbler hunting in West Virginia. They even make they even make firearms that are sold here. That's a 12 gauge shotgun on top. And a 222 on the bottom, like, you know, over and under. Rifle shotgun combos. That's nice. So you gotta understand that these two people were close enough to kill with a 12 gauge shotgun. They slaughtered a 7-year-old boy. They shot his sister. They shot the daddy. They shot the family friend with two rounds from a 12-gauge shotgun. They were obviously close enough to see that the little children were taking a pee. They were close enough to count the number of people in the group. They were close enough to understand that no one was trespassing on their property. However, Sheila Moose picked up the phone and called 911 and told the dispatch, "They're out here tearing up the levee, so I shot them." Yeah, really. And I'm proud to be an American. Second Amendment, more important than any other amendment because it allows us to defend ourselves against government tyranny. You know, the kind of government tyranny that would prefer that people stopping the four-wheeler to let a little child go pee-pee, not have their brains blown out. Yeah, this was earlier this month. It took Donald Coffey Jr., 7 years old, 2 days to die. This all happened about 40 miles northeast of Houston. And this was not, bear in mind, you know, well, you know, maybe they were using a slug gun. No, this was shot. Donald Coffey Sr. had a pellet wound in his right shoulder. His daughter Destiny was hit in the elbow. They damn near shot these people at point-blank range. Now, my money says they're probably registered voters. Anybody want to guess how they're registered? Remember, rebel flag over the house? Trespassers will be shot. Survivors will be reshot. Smile, I will. Here's the fun part. As of the publication of the article in the Houston Chronicle on May the 9th, these two monsters had not been charged with murder. the newspaper article from the Associated Press says that Sheriff Bishop said the district attorney could upgrade the charges to murder on Monday. That's something they'll look into with the DA. We're still trying to get the circumstances behind the incident. Irony of ironies, this took place in Liberty County, Texas. This all happened at about 9 p.m. So not only are they within visual range, they're within visual range at night. Yeah. Liberty County Chief Deputy Ken DeFour called the shooting ludicrous. No, deputy. You know, at least they didn't do that thing that Florida show. This is completely incomprehensible to me. No, he called it ludicrous. No, deputy, let me help you with the language a little bit. It's not ludicrous. It's murderous. Murderous. There's the word. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to everybody who makes this all happen. Thanks to Horn intern Junior Grade Ferg. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional, John Fox, our chief engineer, Ben Birch, the hardest working, most overworked man in liberal talk, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you for your calls, your emails, your financial support. If we survive, it'll be because of you. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Thank you, all of you. Be back tomorrow. You know what tomorrow is, right? Front Porch Friday. Get your rocking chair going. It's going to be a good one. And always, 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 Gina. It's all for you.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Did you hear President Obama's speech today? If you didn't, I'm going to request that when you're through listening to myself and Bob tonight, that you find it on the web. I have to say, I haven't found, as of this broadcast, the full speech. Don't just watch the excerpts. Watch the full 50-minute speech. It'll be posted, I'm sure, eventually, probably by the time Bob finishes his show tonight. President Obama has an amazing way to deal with problems. Whenever he has a real difficulty, something that people are talking about in the media, overemphasizing, whenever he finds people running from fear or politics, he does exactly the opposite of what the past administration did. When that happened to the past administration, they hid under a rock. But Barack Obama comes out full square and reasonably, rationally, in detail, lays out his thinking behind what he is doing, what he intends to do, why he intends to do it, and most importantly, how it fits in with the rule of law and the Constitution. I'd like to say it was a masterful performance today, and no doubt our president is a very good speaker. And yet, with all due lack of humility, as Bob Kincaid pointed out when I mentioned this to him, I've been saying exactly these same things for the past 5 years. Do you think President Obama's been listening into my show? I can't say I'm the only one. Many, many commentators have been saying these things. And the irony is that his speech dealt with exactly the problems I discussed right here on the air over the last couple of days. 2 days ago, in a show that will be repeated tomorrow, I did a debate with Mike Lane that I entitled Haunted by the Bush Administration. Already in today's Washington Post, somebody has copied my headline. Because it is a haunting. Haunting in the sense of a ghost that won't go away, that has to be dealt with, that's getting in the way of a president that definitely wants to move on and deal with such essential issues as the economy and health care and the environment and jobs and civil rights and education and you name it. But also haunted by the fact that left and right can't give it up. And I understand why, and I talked about why I understood why. As I mentioned in my broadcast, the great novelist William Faulkner once said, "The past is not dead, it's not even past." The past is not past. What brilliance. Faulkner was right. The past constantly informs the present. And it is our history of the past, our telling of that story, our understanding of what happened before, that explains who we are and what we are doing today. Perhaps the past will never be the past. But unless we work through it, unless we exercise our ghosts, we can never move on to a very important present. Well, Barack Obama did that today, and I think he did it masterfully. And I agreed with about 98% of what he said. He dealt with everything, and we'll go through it. He dealt with everything, everything from what he's going to do with the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay to the release or lack of release of the photographs, the release of the memos, to how it is he's going to structure military commissions. And in all his speech, there were three words repeated again and again and again, like a mantra. Three words that I've been using pretty consistently for the last 6 years. Rule of law. I haven't counted how many times in speech he used rule of law. I would suspect it was a couple dozen, perhaps only exceeded by the number of times he mentioned the Constitution. Standing in the National Archives of Washington, D.C., surrounded by the original of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. And Barack Obama made clear that the way the past administration prosecuted this war was contrary to our laws, contrary to our Constitution, contrary to international norms, contrary to the American way. And yet, he fully understood the need to protect our country. And still, he understood that there doesn't have to be a contradiction between those two principles, as much as the Republican Party wants to make it seem like there is. He even talked about the politics of it all. I was astonished yesterday when I was talking about Congress. I mentioned a lot of good they had done on credit cards and such. But there was ugly, too. And perhaps the ugliest thing that happened yesterday was when Congress voted by overwhelming numbers, 90-6 in the Senate, a vote I would have been in the six, the minority, 90-6 saying, we're not going to give you money to take down Guantanamo until you tell us what you're going to do with the prisoners. All right, fine. Obama told us today in detail. As I said yesterday, it was pure political posturing. It was Congress saying, all right, you have to tell us first, as if they didn't trust this president to make sure that there wouldn't be terrorists running loose on American soil. Okay, all right, fine. That's why I said I think it was a tempest in a teapot. Let them go ahead and vote that way. But now that they've heard the speech today, they will proceed with dismantling of Guantanamo Bay. Let's go through what our president told us today. First of all, he detailed why the past way of doing things is not the right way to go forward. It's not just torture. It's not just the enhanced interrogation techniques. The fact is, those techniques were illegal, unlawful. And part of the controversy over what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi knew and when she knew it goes into how the CIA tells members of Congress about these kinds of things. That was done in an illegal manner as well. We can discuss the details of that later on in the hour. But at the heart of Barack Obama's speech was the absolute understanding that checks and balances are the hallmark of the American Constitution. Now, you know, he was a constitutional lawyer. That should go without saying. Obviously, that's true. And yet, these words to me, I don't know, I guess they made me swoon. Maybe because I hunger, I ache, I thirst for the rule of law after 8 years of lawlessness.